Accession number 19667, Reel 1.
Johannes Lichthelm? Johannes Lichthelm, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Voorburg, next to The Hague in Holland.
So, this is the area known as South Holland?
Correct.
Which year were you born?
I was born in 1914.
Can you tell me something about your family background, please? About your mother and father?
Yes. My father was born, I think, in 1884. I'm not quite sure. My mother was about 19 when she came to Holland, and that was roughly in 1912, so that makes it 93.
Which part of Germany had she come from?
She came from Ludwigslust in Mecklenburg, where I went just a few months ago for the first time since about I was youngster.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was the son of somebody who had a shop in Voorburg, selling bedding, materials, that kind of thing. And then he took on another job. They were looking from the sugar beet factories for salespeople who would sell wet sugar beet pulp to the farmers. And that's the part that my father took over. And my uncle took over the shop in Voorburg. So they split that up. So then when I became about 17, 18, I came into my father's business.
Where had you been at school?
In Voorburg, yes. I'd been in primary school and in further education school, a MULO it was called, which is not as high as what my brother went into. He went into the HBS, which is a school and a college, really, which you can run until you're suitable to go to university. But as things would have it, he only did about 2 years there, and then we had to, you know, make haste to get away.
Yeah. So in the 30s, you were working in your father's business?
In my father's business, yes. And I went with him in his business, went through the bad years of 1928 to 1932, roughly.
What were they like in South Holland?
The Dutch didn't have as quite as bad, being a very international country with lots of import, export, etc. They didn't suffer too much. We didn't have all these sort of starving people like the States had, like England had. Now, we had some unemployed, of course. But I think we did fairly well in relation to the other people, yeah. And Germany, of course, as well. Germany was very bad.
Did you have to do national service?
Yes, but being in our own business, I did have the opportunity of doing a 1.5 year of training, very poor training, really, in the infantry. On Wednesday nights and Saturday.
Why do you say it was very poor training?
Well, we found that out when the war started.
But did you realize at the time that it was poor training?
No, we didn't.
In the 30s...
And then we had to do 6 weeks in the barracks, which was not terribly far away from us. 6 weeks in barracks in Leiden, L-E-I-D-E-N, And that was in August and in September. Just 6 weeks, and that was, you know, it did a bit more, of course, then. But we had more or less a little square bashing. We had a little bit more knowledge about machine guns, about your carbine, and various other things. But not really. Now, Holland thought, if anything happens in future, we will be neutral, as they were in the 1914-1918. But of course, that didn't happen. It was a different man. It was not Kaiser Wilhelm, but it was who later on came to Holland and lived there for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Now, when the war broke out in September 1939, did you personally think then that Netherlands could keep out?
We had that sort of idea first, yes. Even the government, I think, had that sort of hope. They never did enough, really, to get us really equipped well enough. Everything was there were penny pinching. We didn't have any tanks. We had some anti-tank guns. Anyway, what we had was very, very little. And they always said, if we get invaded, we'll all pull back behind the big waterways. And that was the idea, which we did, of course, when the war started on the 10th of May, 1940.
And when the 10th of May came, have you personal memories of what happened to you on that day?
Yes. I had, in the years between, I had asked to be transferred to the motorized company or division, which was granted. And when we were, that's the word, mobilized in September of 39, when Poland was entered, we all had to come up in arms. And we stayed in a little village, our motor company, which was lorries, etc., three sections, and one section which was a repair section. And we were just a few miles east of Tilburg. And we had to supply the troops all along the border, Eindhoven and around there, and on the other side of Tilburg. And we used to get our, you know, used our equipment. We had the equipment, and we used to get our goods, of course, picked up from various places west, and then again delivered to the various troop formations in that part of Holland. But on the 10th of May, about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, my lieutenant came in. We were billeted in a nice school in, what's the name? I can't think of it. I'll think of it in a minute. In this little place. And he said, we have been invaded, because he always, you know, was very, very anti-German. And he knew more, I think, than most of us knew. He was the owner of a bicycle factory in the east of Holland. And the emphasis was definitely, they have invaded us. And we have to pull back to the waterlinie, which is the water line, which is, you know, behind the big rivers. And we went from there.
What rank did you have at the time?
I had no rank, I was just ordinary soldier.
How were other people that you came across in the Netherlands reacting on the 10th of May?
Well, we didn't really speak to many people until the war was over 5 days later, after they had bombed Rotterdam. Anyway, we were bombed on one of the roads on the way to to the south, northwest, in the direction of one of the islands between the rivers. And we had a little bit of experience there, rather than tailed, but not too much. And fortunately, when we came to a very open road, and luckily enough we came to a part where there were some woods, suddenly three what I think were Dorniers attacked us from a fair height, about reasonable height, about 1,500 feet. And I did the same. I just came up from the back of the column and saw that everybody was scattering left, right and everywhere. And I did the same. I went to the left, and I must have passed my lieutenant and his driver, and I went another 25 yards, roughly. There was a little hill there. What sort of hill it was, I don't know. Not very big. And at top of the hill, there was a hole dug. Not very deep, probably a foot deep, and about the size of a dog basket. No, a big dog's basket. And I thought, well, if I go in here, only a direct hit will kill me. But the other bombs, I saw the bombs already coming, first wobbling, 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 and then straightening out in a big arch. And I thought, well, if it falls near me, it won't kill me. It won't injure me. And I was lucky. Then after that, they came over twice more, and nobody, not even me, thought about going to the lorry on which just a fortnight before, roughly, we had had machine gun mounted on the platform, and nobody thought about defending themselves. Everybody was scattered, and I followed, yeah, the same routine. I forget it ever since, because they came over again at the lower height and machine gunned us. Then they came over at a very low height, possibly about 500 feet or something like that. Well, we would have had a lovely pick at them. Beautiful, but nobody did. Anyway, as that was over, I went back, you know, and I met the driver, which I think his name was Eddie. Eddie said, the lieutenant is dead. I said, what? Yes, there he is. And we went to see it. Had a big hole in his shoulder, you know, big enough to put two big hands in. So he was dead at once. And he said he must have had a premonition. He said he was so unusual this morning. I said he was not his own. And I said, whether, you know, he just had that sort of feeling that something was going wrong. And then we went all back to our vehicles. Despite the seriousness of the whole situation, one of our men was running around and saying, I lost my leg, I lost my leg. Of course, we couldn't help laughing about it because he was running around. But we found out that he had a splinter in his thigh or somewhere on his behind. And we left him in the next village, you know, so as to be seen to. Anyway, then I had to report to the sergeant, was the one who would be our section commander. And I went to the captain and said, what are we doing now? I said, well, just make sure that everybody's following. And I went, more or less, I was the only dispatch rider. I never saw the other one, or the third one, who was from the maintenance section. The maintenance section, I couldn't find first. They were at least, I think, 1.5 to 2 miles behind us. And I found them in the pub. The adjutant, who is the section leader, with some of his men. I said, you've got to follow. Oh, he said, we've got to get over the shock first. We had two wounded. I said, well, we had our lieutenant killed. You got to follow. Yeah, I'll follow when I'm ready. So I went back to the captain, and we had already advanced some distance. And he said, go back and tell him he got to follow immediately. I did not like the attitude of this adjutant. And later, we heard that most likely he had been an NSB'er, which is, you know, one of the Quislings, which stands for National Socialist Movement, which they gave it the name as if they were socialist, but that was the tricks of the Germans to always, you know, sort of miss a number, the words, so that people would get the wrong impression. Anyway, he had several of the Limburgers, and Limburg is on the east bottom side of Holland, and he had several under his command. And they were a bit, well, so not anti-German, or they were pro-German, or whatever. Anyway, we didn't find out too much until later on, after the war, of course, what the situation was. Anyway, I didn't like that attitude of the adjutant. And there was another thing, which was rather private. I had a Royal Enfield motorbike with a very sloppy frame, and I was used to an aerial motorbike myself, which was firm frame and everything, very good bike, but the Royal Enfield was not much. And this section had a BMW, but you never saw that bloody thing. Express, you know, apologies for my French. And it was a funny setup. You never, yeah, they were never there. They were what we call in the RAF skiving most of the time. So, you know, I never liked the whole setup. Anyway, we got, without any further happenings, we got to the island, and we had to go via a ferry, which was pulled by chain across the river. And while we were waiting, and it took only, took hours to get the whole company across, because I think there were no more than about 8 lorries possible on one ferry. So it took a long time, and it was pitch black. We had heard once an aircraft come over, which was machine gunning, but we didn't have any bad result of that. So that was unusual, because I don't think the Germans had a lot of night flying pilots. And they probably could do that because they were flying along the rivers, which you can always see, no matter how dark it is. You know, you can see obviously a light coming back from the sky. Of course, the weather was absolutely fantastic for the Germans. The Germans had waited until the weather forecast was correct to attack. Could you switch? So then we were on the island, between all bordered by all the different rivers, which I knew partly of, because we had a gentleman there who was selling for us the wet sugar beet pulp amongst the farmers. Anyway, we arrived, and sort of in the morning, and then I found that 2 lorries were missing. So I went to the captain and said, do you want me to go and find out where they were left? Yes. So it was not very definite. Yes, so I had permission to go and get them. So I took some drivers with me, and a lorry, and 3 drivers. So I have 2 drivers who could bring the other 2 lorries and back again, because I couldn't take them on my motorbike, of course. And we found them, and had run out of petrol. So we bought them back. And that was that. We were on that island 5 days.
What's the name of this island?
I'd have to look it up.
All right.
I'll do it later on.
Doesn't matter.
Okay, then you can fill it in afterwards. So, we did the usual supply. We used to have these river boats, river barges, which came along roughly where we were. We used to load ammunition, food, whatever was needed for the troops on that island. Because a lot of troops, there was one company which was on bikes that come back all from the near enough from the border. And they passed us on the way when we were bombed. They had already passed us. They were faster than we were because, you know, our sections were very, very slow. We had to wait for other troops to pull back, etc., etc. And about the second or the third day, two aircraft started bombing these vessels. Luckily, I think there was nobody on board, so the captain and his wife and family, they must have gone into the village, you know, and sort of didn't stay on the vessels. And with one other of our troops, I said, God, we've got to go back and ask the captain if he can have the machine gun. And we settled in the bottom of the dike. You know, the dike is, you know, here a dike, especially in Norfolk, a dike is where the water is. But in Holland, a dike is the protection against the water, high water in the rivers, protecting the polders.
The embankment.
The embankment. And of course, there would have been the grass was very long, and they wouldn't have seen us really. We could have had a real good pick. No, 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 he said, we got to keep ourselves very quiet. They mustn't know that we are here because we got to supply the troops. That didn't come through anyway. Anyway, I was driving at night. I was doing all sorts of things as a dispatch rider in the daytime. And in the end, second and third night, I was keeping one hand on the throttle and keep my eye open with my other hand. You know, you didn't get any sleep at all. So in the end, I had a screwdriver and I put the throttle so that if I left it, it would stay in that position. So now and then I could keep my right eye open. And that's how you went on. But eventually, of course, I must have fell asleep somewhere, sometime. And then the news came that Rotterdam had been burnt and that we had capitulated. That was the fifth day. And we all had to see that we got home. We had to hand in all our equipment, all our guns, and we had carbines because they're shorter and not so dangerous on a motorbike. And we had a pistol and all that sort of thing. The machine gun, everything. Blankets, beautiful blankets we had been given. You know, we never had as good a blanket as that at home because this was super quality. They were green, especially green for the troops. And the whole army had been supplied with blankets, of course, from the blanket factories in the south of Holland. And all that had to be delivered to the Germans. That was a very serious thing for us. We couldn't believe it, that we had to surrender. But they had threatened the Germans that if we wouldn't surrender, Amsterdam and other cities would follow. And with their incendiary bombs, of course, they sort of laid flat everything. Also, the corn exchange and the church and something else in Rotterdam, they were saved. The corn exchange was a fairly new building where I used to go every Monday to meet my customers. And there were just, you know, glass broken in the roof, a few tables with the corn on it, samples, etc. They had burned a bit, but everything else was concrete and glass and goodness knows what. So they and the mayor, what is it, the town hall was also saved, but on the whole, everything else was flat, completely burnt out. So then we had to find our way home with another chap who was from The Hague. He happened to have a bicycle. I had my bicycle with me. And we cycled to a ferry to the south. And from the south, we had to turn to the bridges over the longest, which was at that time still the longest bridge in Europe. The Moerdijk, and the Moerdijk bridge for traffic had been blown up by our engineers, but they hadn't blown up the railway bridge, unfortunately. So whether the Germans dropped some parachutists there and they didn't have the chance, I don't know, could be. They did drop parachutists in various parts of the country, and also on a small place, a small aerodrome near where I lived. Anyway, we had to make a long detour after that to get home, because nobody was allowed through Rotterdam. All the traffic and everything that was still there, you know, had to go further west. And we managed to get home somewhere about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning the next day on our backs. And then, of course, we realized that the war broke out on the 10th of May. And that was my sister's birthday. Nobody ever thought about it, that it had been her birthday. You know, things like that are not important, are they? Anyway, I started as much as possible with my father the business again, which was, of course, you know, not very great at that moment. And I met a friend. Somebody I knew who had been a sergeant in the infantry and also during the war. And we started an organization trying to get connections, trying to get weapons which we knew had been dropped at various places in the water. And we managed to get already two machine guns, one a German and one our own machine gun, M something, forget the number of it now, which was a British machine gun, really. And very, very lucky. The German one, I found out from a farmer who lived near the aerodrome, about a couple of miles away from where I used to live. And I knew the farmer. He said there's a machine gun there. But within about 30 meters from there, that point that he pointed out, there was a surveillance tower from the Germans, which is about 10 meters high, something like that. So we had to get it out of that ditch. So it was pretty close. And one night, with her friend, I went on the bike. We waited until it was dark. And